comes the sun. Happy Thursday afternoon to our listeners. My name is Megan Tackett, and you are listening to Everything Under the Sun, our little collaborative half-hour news show that we do from 4 to 4:30 every Thursday between Katie and Kay and the Soper Sun. I am joined today in the studio right now with Shauna Foster. Shauna, thank you so much for joining me. Shauna, you are the Two Rivers Unitarian Universalist, and you've got a solstice thing that you're planning as well today, right?
That's right. Merry Solstice Eve to everybody out there. Solstice is tomorrow, the shortest day of the year for us here in the we're in the Northern Hemisphere, and we are celebrating tonight at the Third Street Center at 5:30 p.m.
Well, again, that makes it, I'm always flattered when guests come to see me anyway, but especially when yeah. I know you've got something going on. So I really, really appreciate it. But the reason I asked you in, and I think we can both agree, is there's an important, relevant topic. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I really appreciate about your activism in particular mm-hmm. is, you know, the Soper Sun and a reporter here, you know, we try to keep it really hyper-local news, but at the same time, I think that there's something to the adage that all politics are local.
Right. Yes. That's right. And yes. That's certainly the case here, where I went to the border in Tijuana, San Diego, where the migrant caravan or migrant exodus is, but we had other people throughout the valley who have visiting the border to see what's going on. There was a couple of people, Jenkins and Nislanik, they went to Tornillo, Texas to witness what was happening at the border there, and Claire Noon, a volunteer attorney from this area, went to help process the kids. There's 15,000 unaccompanied minors on the border right now. Claire went to help process their cases. Jenkins and Nislanik went to go see what it was like and what kind of conditions they were held in. And I really have to give a shout out to those two, because they just went up to Border Patrol and were like, why are you doing this? What do you think? Why? And so they were able to get firsthand from the Border Patrol agency how they thought they were helping the United States society, because so many people in our community are feeling that what is happening at the border is a crisis of our own making.
Yeah, I'm curious. Did they share with you what the Border Patrol said?
They did. The Border Patrol, they do deal with people on a daily basis, and they seem to be very jaded. And Claire Noon even reported about how guards felt jaded towards children in the Dilley, Texas facility that she had volunteered with before, because they have seen so many kids, and it just seems like too much. Maybe a way to protect their own humanity is to pretend that the humanity of the children doesn't exist anymore. And it was really awesome to hear our community members talk about what it meant for them to go to the border. And it was just a really impressive event that we had on the 18th. And I appreciate your write-up of it in The Sun.
Yeah, thank you. For our listeners who are like, wait, what are we talking about?
Right, yeah.
Last Tuesday evening at the Third Street Center, which was International Migrants Day, mm-hmm. In kind of collaboration with the larger Love Knows No Borders grassroots movement, mm-hmm. The Unitarians and
Sanctuary Unidos yeah. put on an event inviting people who have been to the border from this community to talk about, why did they go? What's happening there? How could we help? And why is it relevant to us? I really appreciated Jennifer Smith, who's a local attorney here, talking about what it's like for somebody to apply for asylum and who's living here in this valley, because there are people who apply for asylum who are part of our valley, and how difficult it is for them, because you have to think about, what are the times that you would have to apply for asylum? Well, you'd have to prove that you're being persecuted. But that is really hard proof to have when you don't have a computer, you don't have a cell phone.
You're not literate.
Right. So how are you going to provide documentation that a gang is after you, that the government is after you, that you are being persecuted for any reason? And so these asylum cases are very difficult to win. But the situation in the Central America has deteriorated so greatly in Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala. That's why we have thousands of people coming together in this migrant exodus, because they used to just come 100 and 200 every day, just traveling northward. And when I met with the leaders of the exodus, they said, this makes us so vulnerable to anything that could happen when there's only a group of, you know, dozens of us. Why don't we all just wait? and all come together in mass. And that's why they decided to move forward. Most of them are still around Mexico City, but 1,000 of them were able to get up to the Tijuana border, which resulted in tensions rising as they had a protest. They are trying to get on the United States soil, because as soon as you are on United States soil, you can legally, according to international law, apply for asylum. And this administration has responded to that by limiting the number of people who can apply for asylum and blocking ports of entry so that people cannot reach the United States border. Then you had tear gassing of families and children. And that's when I feel like the faith community really put their foot down and said, we really can't have this happening. We are greater than this. We are better than this. There's a better way to solve this problem. And that's what I was able to witness when I went to San Diego and Tijuana just a week ago.
Yeah, because you were in San Diego and Tijuana, like you said. And in San Diego, very specifically, you were there to answer a call to action to faith leaders to kind of come around for Friendship Park.
Right.
And I loved learning more about Friendship Park and the history of Friendship Park. Can you kind of speak to that?
Yeah. So Friendship Park was set up by former First Lady Nixon, who talked about the relationship between the United States and Mexico. And so set up this park between the nations where annual events take place there. One event is families who are separated by the border coming together and reaching each other through the open holes in the fence. And it's a very touching ceremony. And another one is a religious ceremony, which is Las Posada. And that's about the family, the Holy Family, Mary and Jesus and Joseph. Well, Jesus, who's about to be born, right?
In the womb.
In the womb. Mary and Joseph looking for a place to have the baby and the calling out, can we stay with you? Can we stay with you? Can we stay with you? And then there's a sung response. And usually it's a posada is a merrymaking type of Christmas tradition in Mexico. But when it's sung on the border, there's that much more weight added to the faith of here we have the savior of humankind that can find no place to be born because of these types of borders and these hostilities. And the Border Patrol this year said, nope, no posada, no religious recognition. And instead, the United States military came down and put down razor wire about 400 yards from the border. And the faith community said, well, we can't have posada with this razor wire here. You have to take it away. And so we went to the border to try and convince the agency to remove the razor wire and allow us to have our religious rituals that we have been having for decades.
And what happened once you were actually there?
Well, when we actually got there, we got to a part of Friendship Park where we had a press conference and we did a prayer together. We were anointed and then we tried to get to the wall. And the agency, Border Patrol, would not let us near the wall, even though we had been just last year allowed to be near the wall to conduct posada. But the border has been militarized to a point they wouldn't let us on the other side of this new razor wire that's been put down. The U.S. military put down the razor wire because they really can't do anything else. International law prohibits the military from touching refugees and asylum seekers, which is what all these people are. So putting down razor wire and mucking out latrines is all that our military is able to do, and they really ought to be sent home. So we tried to get on the other side of the razor wire to bless that ground, to reach the people on the other side, and they would not let us go onto the other side. And so they pushed us back, and if we nonviolently resisted, they arrested a great many of us. But then the violence of which the agency was acting with those arrests, grabbing people by the throat, throwing them to the ground, even though we were clearly nonviolent clergy people just trying to enact our religious rituals, we decided that because the way they were arresting people, it was getting too violent. And so we had to say, okay, they're obviously not listening to us. We will have to go back and re-strategize about how can we get posada at Friendship Park back. This would have been the 25th year of that religious tradition there.
Yeah, quarter of a century. So, which brings to another point, this isn't a new thing. The traditions that are existing, like posada, the warm and fuzzies, that's not new. But unfortunately, neither is the negative kind of stuff in terms of treatments and our immigration policy. And I thought it was really interesting when Jennifer Smith, an immigration attorney who was speaking that night, said that, you know, in her line of work, it's known as the invisible wall. Mm-hmm. We don't have, you know, the Trump administration's border wall right now, but we have that invisible wall. All of the deterrence tactics, I think is what you called them, that keeps processes for moving along, like lowering the number of processed applications to 100 a day.
Actually, I think I would contend that this is pretty new. I mean, I'm thinking when Posada started in Friendship Park 25 years ago, you know, just a decade or so before that, Reagan granted amnesty to millions of people, 4 million people living in the United States. We were living under this American dream sort of mythology that if you come here and you work hard, then you will be granted citizenship and integrated into society. That's something that many of us who have European ancestry were taught in schools and heard from our own ancestors. So it really has been since Reagan and since the criminalization, that was a 1994 Act, IRA-IRA, that was passed by the Clinton administration that criminalized people being able to immigrate or seek a better life. And that's really when this invisible wall, it wasn't a way to say, no, we're going to not comply with international law of asylum seekers, but we are going to make it a lot more difficult in a lot more invisible ways. And what is resulting is death by deterrence. If I'm sure you've heard Jacqueline Call, a 7-year-old girl from Guatemala who died because she was not given medical care right away as she came across the border. But the reason why she was in such a dangerous part of the border to begin with is because of the blocking of the ports of entry and the desperation that her family had. If we were honoring the spirit of international law instead of the letter of it and trying to tamp it down as much as possible, Jacqueline would not have died. Her family would have been received at a normal port of entry, and it would have had the due process that is guaranteed by international law.
So one of the things I heard asked over and over and over again is, what can we do?
Well, part of the reason why we wanted to come together on the 18th was because it was a community response. I had gone to San Diego and Tijuana. Other people had gone to Tornillo and had seen the child camps. And then we heard about Jacqueline Call dying. And it just seems like it's so much. But when the community comes together, we could really find the common narrative thread that we do have people in power who should do something about this. So that night, we wrote letters to Senator Bennett. We wrote Christmas cards to people who are in detainment, because it means a lot to these kids and to these moms to be able to get cards to know that people do welcome them. They want to honor the spirit of Christmas, and they're trying everything that they can. And I, that night, took pictures of all the letters that people wrote to Bennett and sent it to Bennett's office. And we got a response. Well, the next day, the Department of Health and Human Services said that they were removing a policy that required FBI fingerprinting background checks of the entire household of people who wanted to sponsor unaccompanied minors. So what that basically means is that hopefully that will be a step of taking down from the 15,000 unaccompanied kids, and those kids will start to be reunited with their sponsors a lot more quickly. Now, that isn't ideal, because the sponsors are still undergoing these FBI fingerprint background checks that, I'll add, the people in the camps that are with the kids right now, they don't have to have that level of background checks. But the people who want to sponsor these kids have to have that level, and it really slows things down. So the very next day, we had that announcement from the Department of Health and Human Services and Department of Homeland Security that they recognized that that was not working. And then today, Senator Bennett just signed a letter with a lot of his other colleagues saying that the Health and Human Services needs to close those camps as soon as possible. And I think it was really important that we were there influencing them, saying, listen, we need you to do this. And then they did it.
Yeah, absolutely. And worth noting, those holiday cards that you made, you know, we talk about these detention facilities along the southern border, but that's not to where those cards were going. That was going to a facility in Aurora, Colorado.
That's right. In Aurora, Colorado, it's run by this group called GEO, and they're a for-profit prison complex that your tax dollars pay for. And people who are under detention, having the due process of their deportation, often, if they can't afford bail, are housed there. And they're housed there even if they've been ordered to be deported, because they have to pay for their own deportation back to their country of origin, and they can't, a lot of times they can't afford it. So what you're paying for as a taxpayer is for people just to sit in a detention center in Aurora, and they can't do anything. They might be able to earn a dollar a day in order to raise money to be able to afford their own deportation. And that is in Aurora, Colorado. And there's a great organization called Casa de la Paz, which is working with people who get out of that detainment facility and trying to reunite people with their families as they're released from that facility, and also had a large role in reuniting families that were separated at the border.
And just to clarify, GEO, which won the contract from ICE and established this facility in 1986 in Aurora to house about 150 people. It now houses more than 1,500 people. That is a for-profit entity.
Yes, that is. Yeah. Not all of the detainment centers and detention centers are for-profit. For instance, the one in Tornillo, Texas is a not-for-profit, but they are a faith-based group, and they have said, you know what, we are in the business of setting up temporary shelters after emergencies. This crisis is not what we do. And I think it goes to the point that this crisis is a manufactured crisis of our government. As people of faith, we say, you can't do this to people. You can't ignore people's human rights. You can't flout international law and expect us as the general citizenry or people of faith to sit by and let this happen, especially to children.
Well, Shauna Foster, thank you so, so much for joining and sharing. I promised you I would get you out by 4:15 so you can take care of your solstice preparations.
Thank you, yes.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Everything Under the Sun on KDNK, commercial-free since 1983. All of us at KDNK are asking listeners to make an end-of-the-year donation to support community radio. Help us keep presenting unique events like the Halloween Dance Party and the Hoot. Mail a check, stop by the station, call 963-0139, or go to kdnk.org and click donate. Again, you are listening to Everything Under the Sun. My name is Megan Tackett, and I was just having a fascinating conversation with Shauna Foster, who is our Unitarian Reverend, and off to get her her solstice things going on. You're good. And coming into the station to join me is Soper Sun's primo freelancer, really, Justin Patrick. I don't know if he can hear me. Yay, Justin. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate you. I can steal you away from Wilderness Workshop. Everybody in the Valley wears so many hats. So I appreciate you coming in to chat with me.
Well, it doesn't hurt that you're right down the way.
It's that small town benefit, right?
Really? Truly it is.
Well, I'm really jealous because you got to write a story that I've been wanting to write. And so I thought I'd just go right to the source. Page 3 in this week's paper. It's been long, long, highly contentious kind of topic, but it is finally legal to buy full strength beer from grocery stores. You do not have to go to a dedicated liquor store starting January of 2019, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think every Coloradan is familiar with 3-2 beer, and there's probably that moment shortly after you turn 21 where you discover this for yourself or you hear it through the grapevine and you're like, wait, so it's beer. It looks like the other beer, but it's not going to work. It's this old relic from the Prohibition era, and we're one of currently 3 states that offer it. Utah does and Minnesota does, and soon it will just be 2. Wow. And I don't think anybody particularly likes 3-2 beer. It doesn't benefit anyone, I don't think. But people like the situation that has been created by 3-2 beer. So the way it worked is that you could buy 3-2 beer in grocery stores if you wanted to, but you could also go to the liquor store and buy full-strength beer. And now that you're going to be able to do that in grocery stores, that's going to be a change in the paradigm of how the transactions around beer occur. So obviously in favor of this proposal is the major grocery stores, Kroger, for example, and Safeway and others that are salivating over a new potential revenue stream and a potentially big one for them. And they have been behind this for years. I don't know the exact details of how this went down, but I know when I first graduated from college, I was working as a legislative aide for Senator Vega in Denver. And during that time period, she got rid of the blue laws, which you used to be not be able to buy beers in liquor stores on Sundays. And then you were able to. And grocery stores didn't like that because they had the market cornered on Sunday sales. And suddenly, like, you could buy it at liquor stores. So I think that this was part of that discussion. And they've constantly been, like, going back to this. And even with this new law, there are going to be provisions that are going to be unfolding over the next many years, which will probably see more grocery stores selling wine and liquor than they are currently. And there are a few select Safeways and City Markets and King Supers where you can buy liquor and wine, but it's rare. So this is kind of like a whole shift that on the surface, it favors grocery stores and doesn't help liquor stores. But I talked to liquor store owners that are not happy with this at all. And they're seeing right away that the bigger chains are going to be able to endorse lower margins to attract people to buy their beer at a lower cost. And some people do just say, hey, if I'm going to save a buck, I'm going to go there and buy my beer cheaper.
Well, I don't remember when I was, because like you've rightly pointed out, this has been going on for years. And I remember when I was living in Boulder, you know, you can't throw a rock without hitting three dispensaries. And, oh, hold on one moment. It looks like I've got a caller. Let's see. Katie and Kay, this is Megan.
Hey, Megan, it's Jennifer Smith. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thanks so much for calling in, Jennifer. I actually just had Shauna leave. She had solstice preparations to go for. But thank you so much for calling in real briefly, because you did take the time. I'd like to take advantage of it. Just could you take a couple minutes? We were talking about, you know, kind of recapping on the event that was at the Third Street Center. And now all these speakers who had had firsthand experience with the border, you know, were just sharing their stories and thoughts. And it turned out that, you know, we were immediately already, Michael Bennett's office released a statement and it signed, you know, a letter basically saying, yes, we need to close these facilities. Yes, we definitely need to do away with the fingerprint requirements for entire households for potential sponsors. But, you know, with your experience in the law, in terms of that side of it, can you just kind of talk to your experience of before this administration, now with this administration? As you rightly pointed out, this is not unique to, you know, only since 2016, but it has, it seems like it has grown. And can you just kind of speak to your experience as to speculating why that might be?
Sure. I guess I don't want to assume why, maybe, but I can confirm that things are very different now than they were 2 years ago, even. There seems to be this constant, what I like to refer to as the invisible wall, that their administration is constantly putting up roadblocks within the system, making it harder for everyone to use the proper channels. So even, for example, in a family-based marriage case where it's a straightforward application, you know, the government could take 2 years to get to an interview date on a case like that. That is a new length of time that didn't exist before. U visa cases for people who have been victims of violent crime and have reported that crime to police and cooperated with police, been helpful with police, are looking at almost a 10-year waiting period to have their cases adjudicated. So it's these little things all the time. Some big crises that we've seen over the last year were implemented by the Attorney General, who used to be Sessions, but his current replacement is doing the same thing, where they're taking cases that have already been decided by appellate courts and taking those decisions and erasing the decision and rewriting it so that they think the outcome is something that makes it much harder for anyone to bring their valid claim for protection or asylum. And then just today, Secretary Nielsen announced this new, what they're calling historic action of migration protection protocols, where they're going to start, they say they're going to, anyone who presents themselves at from the Mexican land border without proper documents will be given a notice to appear for immigration court and then sent back to Mexico to wait in Mexico for their court hearing. This is contrary to existing law. It's illegal. It's particularly illegal when it comes to people who are seeking asylum. This new proposal that they put out today seems directed at anyone claiming asylum, but we have case law that already exists that says that this rule cannot be applied to anyone seeking asylum. So, again, it's the government's attempt to create a problem where it doesn't exist. It gets media coverage. It gets talk. There's a lot of catchy phrases. There's a lot of things for the media to talk about. But in the end, when you get down to it, most of these policies are being stopped in federal court, being prevented from applying, and they continue to try to do things that sound good but aren't legal. And it's this constant building of roadblocks to people who are trying to do things correctly.
I wish I could say that's, I don't even have a proper emotional response and words for that.
I don't think anyone does, because it seems very unprecedented. I mean, I think the hard thing for immigration practitioners, nonprofits, and anyone else that's savvy to this world and involved in it is feels overwhelmed by the constant attack on, you know, the very people that make up our country. Like I said, we have a system in place. We have processes. We have procedures. We have extreme vetting. We have all these things. And so by putting up these new fancy things they get out in the media, they're not fixing a problem, right? They're just creating one.
Right. And inspiring.
Like they don't have to put kids in shelters. They don't have to do things that way. They don't have to have all these roadblocks to the process. Those weren't needed before. There wasn't a problem that came of it. And it's so that these self-created problems, like, oh, well, you know, this was a problem. Well, actually, it wasn't a problem, but it's something I know you like to talk about in the media. Unfortunately for all of us, the immigration system is super complicated. It is so complicated. It's not easy. It doesn't dwindle down to a sound bite. And that's why it's so hard to get anything done or changed, because the laws are so complex and convoluted and outdated that we really need a comprehensive view of how they fit together and what our goals as a country are with the program. And, you know, those goals can include security, and they should include security. We do need to have a better sense of, you know, who's coming in and out of the U.S. and why. Absolutely. But I think targeting one particular kind of person who seems to only, you know, is very improper and is just creating a problem that didn't need these quote-unquote solutions.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and giving those insights. I think you nailed it on the head. I think culturally we need to address and have a real conversation of what does it mean to be an American in relation to our neighbors and people who are seeking help. So thank you so much. Like I said, as an immigration attorney, I just really appreciate having that insight of knowing the logistics of really, truly, beyond the soundbite, what's really going on. So thank you for calling.
Oh, well, thanks for asking, Megan. And happy holidays.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks, Jennifer.
Okay, bye.
In context of that, changing the law to allowing full-strength beer seems a lot more manageable, I suppose.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, thank you for that. And this is a call-in show, 963-2976. That is also true for our next show here in the next couple of minutes with Ask the Vet. Justin, thank you so much for coming in. Any last second kind of things that we didn't get a chance to kind of touch on? I mean, I know there's so much and we've got a page 3 story about it, but anything that was a major takeaway for you when you were doing the reporting, talking to different people?
No, not in particular. You know, I would definitely read the story. It's nice to be informed about what's going to be happening. But, you know, as a consumer, I'm kind of excited to be able to see what the grocery stores will offer. The City Market spoke to me on the phone and said they're going to make a genuine effort to introduce craft beers into their stores.
Excellent. Because I know that was the big concern for a long time was, wait, no, you know, mom and pop brewer who could talk to mom and pop liquor store and get their stuff on the shelves, that's not going to happen as easily for City Market.
Yeah. But they claim it will be. They claim their door is going to be open. So we'll see what happens. And, you know, some change is good. And I think we can all agree that we're better off without 3-2 beer on our shelves. So that's probably a good thing.
I remember once, this is awful, there were some tourists that were, you know, about to pick some up. And I tried to intervene and they got real rude. And they're like, I know you're in Colorado, but we don't need help. Thanks. And I was like, fine.
I would be so dumbfounded. Yeah, if you go to Tennessee and someone's like, that bourbon,
that's not real.
Don't drink it.
Yeah, that's not real.
Yeah,
you go, what? So great. Well, Justin Patrick, thank you so much for your stories, as always, gracing our pages
sure.
in the Soper Sun. And thanks for joining me today.